This is Audible.
Ashet Audio presents Wrath of Empire, Book 2 in the Gods of Blood and Powder series, by Brian McClellan. Read by Christian Rotzka. Prologue. Orts stood at the bottom of a narrow flight of steps, head tilted toward the light streaming in from the open hatch above him. He could hear gulls calling above and feel the gentle rocking of the ship as it sat in harbour. Both sensations had become ubiquitous to him these last few months.
"Go on," a voice said.
Orts looked over his shoulder at the Morion-helmed soldier standing just behind him. The soldier held a short pike, a ceremonial weapon carried by some of the Boni bodyguards. Orts wondered where they were. What port had the floating prison sailed into this time? More importantly, he wondered which Boni had come to gawk at him now. Boni's were not unlike privileged. Their vast power was contained within fragile human bodies that could be broken as easily as any ceramic vase. Boni's could die. This bodyguard could die. Orts envisioned himself stalking through the ship, murdering everyone in his path before swimming to shore and disappearing into the countryside.
"We don't have all day," the soldier behind him said, thrusting the blade of the pike against the small of Orts's back. "Move!"
Orts snorted and took the first heavy step, careful lest the weight of his chains cause him to lose his balance and tumble backward onto the soldier's blade. He jangled as he climbed, feeling the iron shackles scrape against his bare skin, and within a few moments he stepped out into the light of day for the first time in months. He blinked, trying to let his eyes adjust, but was shoved along in front of the soldier. Several other guards arrived, forming a cordon around him, pushing and prodding him along the deck, half blind, and then up another flight of stairs to the ship's forecastle. Orts felt a hand on his shoulder and jerked away, turning toward the railing and gazing through the pane of the light at an unfamiliar shore. A city rose above him, high on an immense plateau covered in strange buildings. He felt his breath catch in his throat. During the long, secluded journey, he had thought they were taking him to a new prison somewhere in Dionyse. This was not Dionyse. This city, this plateau, he knew only one like it in the storybooks. Landfall. He was not given further opportunity to wonder. Hands grasped him by the chains and pulled him forward, driving him to the other edge of the forecastle, where he was kicked to his knees. He fell without a sound, ignoring the pain as he had been taught, and instead raised his eyes to find the Boni he'd already guessed had called for him. Orts had never met the old man sitting straight-backed on a stool, sipping from a tiny porcelain cup, but he knew him by description and reputation. Kar Sediel was the Emperor's second cousin and chief adviser, and most people in Dionyse knew him as the true power behind the crown. He was a Boni who had risen to power on a tide of blood and taken credit for ending the Dionyse civil war. Orts was not impressed. As a dragon man, he was not impressed by much. Kar Sediel finished his tea and handed the cup to an attendant, then placed his hands palm down on his knees and stared out to sea. Orts began to think that he was being purposefully ignored when he heard a commotion behind him. Another person, wrapped in chains similarly to Orts, was dragged up to the forecastle and thrown to her knees. Then another was brought up, and then another, until six men and women knelt before Kar Sediel. Orts examined his companions. He only recognized two of them, but all five were covered in inky black tattoos, their bodies hard as granite. They were like him. Six dragon men, all in one place. "This is an auspicious gathering," Orts said softly. Carcediel finally turned his head, sweeping his gaze across all the prisoners. When he spoke, his voice was gentle, forcing Urs to strain to hear him over the creaking of the ship and the squawking of the gulls.
"Do you know what you all have in common?"
They were all dragon men, but Urs suspected that was not the answer Carcediel sought. Urs looked one way, then the other, at his five companions. The woman to his left had long, dirty red hair that covered most of her face, but he remembered the scar across her left eye. Her name was Ji Kanari, and 7 years ago she desecrated a Bonai temple for reasons he never learned. The man to his right, willowy and small of stature, was named Ji Matl. 9 years ago, he was assigned to guard one of the Emperor's cousins, whom he bedded. No one spoke up, so Urts cleared his throat.
"We have all disgraced ourselves in the eyes of the Emperor."
"Very good."
Carcediel stood up, and Urts couldn't help but smile at how old and frail he looked. He could snap Carcediel like a twig, if not for these chains. Carcediel noticed the smile, and his brow wrinkled. He took a step over to Urts.
"Tell me, dear Urts, what was your crime?"
Urts closed his eyes, thinking of the last few years spent in his dungeon or that, every movement restricted, always watched, like a prize dog gone rabid whose masters could not bear to put him down.
"I did not bow during an audience with the Emperor."
"And why did you not bow?"
"Because he is not my emperor."
Carcediel gave an almost grandfatherly sigh and gestured toward the shoreline and the city on the plateau.
"The civil war is over. Your false emperor is dead, and the governments of both sides have reconciled. We have turned our wars outward, as is proper, and we have come to Fitrasta to reclaim land that was once ours. We have come to find our God, and we have done so together, united."
He sighed once more, shaking his head like a disappointed teacher, and Urts found himself annoyed that after all he and his companions had suffered, Carcediel would treat them all like children.
"Why are we here?"
Urts asked. Carcediel looked down at him, a hint of disgust in his eyes, then raised his hands toward the chained dragonmen.
"You have all disgraced yourselves in the eyes of the Emperor, and your positions as dragonmen prevent us from spilling your blood. Every one of you will live long lives alone in the darkness, left to rot away."
"Or?" Urts asked. He could smell it now, the scent of an option, a way out. He tried to think of what he knew about Carcediel. The Car was a driven man, cold and thoughtful, but given, from time to time, to rage. He'd built his power by destroying or subjugating all that opposed him. He was a man who did not take no for an answer, and did not leave any enemy standing. Annoyance flashed briefly across Carcediel's face at Urts's interruption. He lowered his hands.
"Or you can redeem yourselves. My armies have taken Landfall. We will take Fitrasta in due time. Meanwhile, I have an errand that needs to be run, and I cannot spare any of the dragonmen, privileged, or bone eyes in my army."
The invasion of Fitrasta had been planned for almost a decade, but Urts still found himself surprised that it had actually happened, that the treaty between the two sides of the civil war had managed to hold long enough for this to happen. He needed more information about the invasion. What kind of people had been found in Fitrasta, their weapons and their warriors? But that would come later, he was sure of it. Ji Kanari, the scarred woman beside Urts, finally raised her head. Orts could see the eagerness in her eyes and couldn't help but judge her. Dragonmen should hide their emotions better.
"What is this errand, Great Car?"
Shikunari asked.
"How can we be redeemed?"
Kasedil put his hand out, brushing his fingertips along Jikanari's forehead. She shuddered at the sensation.
He said, "There were humiliations suffered in the taking of landfall. Humiliations against the army, and humiliations against the dragonmen. I have already sent soldiers to deal with the former, but the latter..."
He trailed off, smiling coldly.
"One of your order, one of the very best dragonmen by the name of Ji Kushal, was murdered in landfall by a common soldier."
"So?" Orts asked. He felt emboldened. This was a way out now, and Carsedil was going to give it to him. But he did not trust Carsedil, and he would ask questions.
"Many common soldiers have killed dragonmen. There are overwhelming numbers, or lucky shots, or..."
"In single combat,"
Carsedil cut him off. Orts heard his teeth click together as he quickly shut his mouth. The hair on the back of his neck stood on end. He'd heard rumours of powder mages, sorcerers who might have the speed and strength to kill a dragonman with the aid of their magic. But Carsedil would have said so if it was one of those. For a common soldier to kill a dragonman in single combat, that was a humiliation. Carsedil looked toward the land again, one hand twitching as if in impatience.
"I do not stand for such humiliation. This soldier is an old warrior, and if given time, may attract followers. He may become even more dangerous than he already is. I am cutting you loose, all six of you. I want you to work together, with Ji Kanari in command."
A smile crossed Ji Kanari's face. Orts resisted the urge to roll his eyes. A small part of him wanted to spit on Carsidial's feet and tell him off, but a much larger part had no interest in spending the rest of his life in chains. He would accomplish Carsidial's task, and then he would revel in his freedom.
"Who is this soldier?" Orts asked.
"Here is a lancer by the name of Ben Stike," Carsedil replied. "Find him and bring me his head."
Chapter 1. As a child, General Vlora Flint had heard stories of refugee camps formed during the Girlish Wars. Whole cities displaced, a million people on the run from enemy armies, or even forced from their homes by their own soldiers. The camps, she'd been told, were places of untold suffering and misery. Disease and starvation were rampant, bodies left unburied, and the people living in constant fear of the next army to come upon them. Vlora, in all her nightmares, had never imagined herself de facto leader of such a camp. She stood on a gentle rise overlooking the Hadshaw River Valley and surveyed the long, winding string of wagons, tents, and cookfires that stretched into the distance. It was early morning, the air heavy and humid, and all she could think about was the numbers that her quartermasters had brought her just an hour ago. They'd finished their counts and estimated that over 300,000 people had fled landfall, just over a third of the city, and that of those, some 220,000 were following this river valley toward Redstone. Her own men, including the Mad Lancers and the landfall garrison, had been badly mauled during the defense of the city. She had less than 10,000 men under her command, just one soldier for every 22 people. How in Adam's name was she going to organize this mess, let alone protect it? She pulled herself out of her own head and looked at the camp below her. She could pick out her soldiers walking up and down the river, waking people up, telling everyone it was time to get moving. 3 weeks since the Battle of Landfall, and disease was already beginning to spread. Many of her own soldiers had contracted dysentery. Food and medicine were in short supply. Most people had left the city in a panic, grabbing valuables rather than necessities, and fled without plan or destination. She inclined her head slightly toward the man waiting patiently beside her. Olam was of middle height, a few inches taller than her, with sandy hair and a greying beard. He walked with a slight limp, and his right arm was still in a sling from a bullet wound from landfall. He was a Nacht, possessing a singular sorcerous talent that kept him from needing sleep. But even he looked tired as piss, with crow's feet in the corners of his eyes and his face gaunt with worry. She wanted to order him to rest, but knew he'd ignore her. She wasn't entirely sure what she'd do without him. "Any sign of the Dianites?" she asked, turning from her view of the refugees to look back down the river the way they'd come. Landfall was about 60 miles to their southeast, and the road that direction was dotted with stragglers. Her own army was camped here, guarding the rear of the refugee convoy. Olam sucked on a cigarette, smoke curling out of his nostrils, before giving a measured response.
"Scouting parties," he said. "They're watching us leave. But I imagine they're too busy solidifying their hold on landfall to bother coming after us. For now."
"You know," Vlora said, shooting him a sour look, "you could leave off the for now. It just sounds ominous."
"I never tried to give you anything but the facts," Olam responded straight-faced. "And the fact is, they're leaving us alone. I can't imagine it'll last forever. I've got our dragoons sweeping our rear, trying to catch one of those scouting parties, but they've come up with nothing so far."
Vlora swore inwardly. She needed to know the state of the city. She and her men had won the Battle of Landfall, only to be forced to abandon it at word of an even bigger Dianai's army on the way. Last she knew, that army had begun to land near the city, and she had no intelligence since then. How big was that army? Were they pushing outward aggressively? Were they taking their time to fortify the city? Did they have more privileged sorcerers and bone eyes? Beyond food and supplies for so many people, the next most valuable commodity was information. She needed to know whether the Dianais were hot on her heels. She also needed to know if the Phatrastan army was heading in this direction, because that offered its own set of complications.
"Any word from Lindet?"
Olam pursed his lips.
"Nothing official. We have taken in nearly 2,000 Black Hats. None of them seem to have orders, or know of the falling out between you and their Lady Chancellor. I've put them to work as a police force among the refugees."
Olam's ability to keep even the biggest army occupied and organized never failed to amaze her.
"You're a saint, but keep a close eye on those Black Hats. Any of them could be Lindet's spies.
She may have left town 2 steps ahead of us, but if she didn't leave eyes and ears to keep track of me, I'll eat my hat."
"And I mine," Olam agreed. "But I've got my own men among them. I'll keep things sorted as best I can. Did you know Stike is openly recruiting from the Black Hats to fill out the ranks of his lancers?"
Vlora snorted.
"With success. More than I expected. Is making them renounce their loyalty to the Lady Chancellor before they can sign on. The Black Hats are damned angry she abandoned so many of them without orders. He's got over 100 already.
And may Adam help any spies he catches," Vlora said.
She hesitated, her eyes on a string of horsemen riding single file along the other side of the river.
They were a company of hers, wearing their tall dragoon helmets and crimson uniforms with blue trim, straight swords, and carbines lashed to the saddles.
Did I make a mistake giving Stike command of my cavalry?
I don't think so, Olam replied.
You hesitated.
Did I?
Laura clasped her hands behind her back to keep from fiddling with her lapels.
Lindet told me he's an uncontrollable monster.
I get the feeling,
Olam responded, dropping his cigarette butt and crushing it beneath the heel of his boot, that Lindet's version of the truth is whatever is convenient at the time. Besides, right now, he's our monster.
Again, that's not reassuring.
Laura tried to get a rein on her thoughts. They were unfocused, scattered, and the sheer number of uncertainties running through her head was enough to drive her mad. There was so much to attend to within her own army. Black Hat stragglers, the city garrison, the mad lancers, and the core of the brigade of mercenaries she had brought with her from Adro. She had over 5,000 picked men, many of them wounded, half a world away from their homes without an employer. A desperate bark of a laugh escaped her lips, and Olam shot her a worried glance.
"You all right?" he asked in a low voice.
"I'm fine," she said reassuringly. "There's just a lot to take in."
"You know these refugees aren't your responsibility," Olam said, not for the first time.
"Yes, they are."
"Why?"
Laura tried to find a satisfactory answer. She wondered what Field Marshal Tamas would have done in such a situation, and realized that he would have marched to the nearest unoccupied city and booked passage home for his troops the moment his contract became null. But she was not Tamas. Besides, there were more reasons to stay in this land than 250,000 refugees.
"Because," she finally answered, "no one else will do it."
"The men are beginning to wonder where their next stack of krana will come from."
Another of 1,000 worries. A little bitter part of her wanted to tell the men that they should be more concerned about getting out of Atrastra alive than their next payment, but she couldn't be too hard on them. They were mercenaries, after all. "Give them promissory notes against my own holdings."
"I already did."
"Without asking me?" Olam gave her a small smile and dug in his pocket for a pouch of tobacco and some rolling papers.
"I figured you'd give the order at some point. But not even you can peer 'em indefinitely."
"I'll figure out something."
Laura waved him off as if she wasn't concerned, but it was a worry that kept her up at night. A thought suddenly hit her, and she squinted down into the camp.
"You know, I haven't seen Taniel or Carpole for a while. Where the piss are they?"
"They remained in the city when we left."
Laura scowled. "And you didn't think to tell me?"
"I did, actually. Twice. You assured me both times that you'd heard every word I was saying."
"I lied."
Laura felt a sudden stab of despair. Despite their rocky history, Taniel was a reassuring man to have around, and not just because he was a one-man army.
"Why would they stay in the city? Are they gathering intelligence?"
Olam shrugged, then hesitated before saying,
"I know you and Taniel have known each other a long time, but don't forget that those two have their own agenda."
It was not a reminder of Laura needed, or wanted. Taniel was more than an old lover. He was an adopted sibling and a childhood friend. Instinct told her to trust him, but years of military and political training reminded her that shared history was a long time ago. So much had changed. With everything going on right now, his disappearance was the least of her worries. She ran her fingers through her tangled hair, wondering how long it had been since she'd had a proper bath. Setting aside her discomfort, she said, "I need information." "Well, we might have something." Olam pointed toward a uniformed messenger hurrying his way up the hill toward them. "It won't be useful," Laura responded, annoyed. "It's going to be some asshole city commissioner trying to hassle me for supplies he thinks we're hoarding from the refugees. Again."
"I'll bet it's something important."
"I bet it's not. I'll bet you that spare pouch of tobacco you keep in the left cuff of your jacket," Olam said. "Deal," Flora said, watching the messenger approach. It was a young woman with a private's insignia on her lapel, and she saluted smartly as she came to a stop. "Mom," the messenger said, "I've got word from Captain Davt." Flora shot Olam a look. "Is it important?" "Yes, Mom. He said he's spotted a Dionysus pursuit force." Flora took a deep, shaky breath as a wave of trepidation swept through her. This would mean a battle. It would mean men dead and the lives of all these refugees at stake. But at least she could finally see her enemy. She dug into her sleeve and pulled out her pouch of emergency tobacco, handing it to Olam without looking at him. Smug bastard. "Take me to Captain Davt." The Hadshaw River Valley was heavily trafficked. The old-growth forests that had once sprawled across this part of Fatrasta logged into extinction over the last couple hundred years. The land was rocky and unforgiving, very unlike the floodplains closer to the city or the plantations to the west. Farmsteads dotted the hilly landscape, surrounded by walls built from the stones the farmers dug from their fields. The occasional rocky precipice was topped by a stand of scraggly honey locusts, and it was in such a vantage point that she found two of her soldiers hunkered on their knees between the boulders. Captain Davt was in his early 20s, with black hair and a soft, beardless face. He tapped powder-stained fingernails against the stock of an ancient blunderbuss and nodded as Flora crept up beside him. His companion was an older woman with greying, dirty blonde hair. Noreen lay with her head against a stone, her rifle propped on a branch, sighting along it as she watched some target only she could see. Anyone else might have found it odd to discover two captains out on a scouting mission, but Flora took it in stride. Like her, they were both powder mages. By ingesting a bit of black powder, they could run faster, see farther, and hear better than any normal soldier. It made them ideal scouts for an army on the run. She'd taken a page out of her mentor's book and given powder mages under her command a middling rank and an auxiliary role. They answered only to her. In addition to scouting, they could also use their sorcery to fire a musket or rifle over fantastic distances, picking off the most difficult targets. "Noreen has an officer in her sights," Dad said in an excited whisper. "Say the word, and they'll be down a ranking metalhead." Laura snorted. Her men had begun to refer to Dino's soldiers as metalheads because of the conical helmets they wore. She lay a hand gently on Noreen's shoulder. "How about you fill me in on what's going on before you start killing people?" Davt looked crestfallen. Noreen gave Laura a thumbs up and kept her bead on her target. "Well?" Flora urged Davt. Davt shifted to make room for Flora to hunker down between him and Noreen in the rocky crag. She crawled up beside them, looking over the edge of their vantage point, and fished a powder charge from her breast pocket. She cut through the paper with her thumbnail and held it to her right nostril, snorting gently. Her senses flared, giving her an immediate high as sounds, colours and smells all became brighter. The world came into focus, and she squinted down the length of the Hadshaw River Highway toward a small party of soldiers in the distance. The powder trance allowed her to see details as if she were a mere 50 yards away, and she took quick stock of the enemy. Long experience at this sort of thing gave her an estimate of 500 or so soldiers at about 2 miles distance. They wore the silver breastplates and bright blue uniforms of the Dionysian soldiery. About half of them rode horses, which was new to Vlora. The Dionysians who'd attacked Landfall had no cavalry. The troop was on the move, the horses trotting while the soldiers marched double time. Every so often they were joined by a rider coming over the ridge from the east or fording the river from the west. Messages were exchanged, and then a dispatch was sent south.
"It's a vanguard," Vlora concluded. "Making regular reports," Davd added. "I'm willing to bet they're no more than a couple of miles ahead of the main army. They're probing, checking the lay of the land and trying to draw out our rear guard."
"They're moving awfully fast for a vanguard."
Davd commented. "So they are."
Vlora took a shaky breath. Her army and the refugees they were guarding were less than 5 miles from the pursuing Dionysians. If the army was travelling as fast as the vanguard, they could force a battle before nightfall. If they took their time, Vlora might have 2 days to prepare. She wondered whether she should attempt to gain a few more miles before nightfall, pushing the refugees ahead of her, or choose a defensive position immediately.
"You two, get me information. I want eyes on the enemy army. I want to know their strength and how fast they're moving. No guns, and don't be seen."
She crawled out of the thicket of honey locusts and returned to the messenger who'd shown her the way.
"We have enemy contact. Have someone prepare my rifles, then go find Major Gustav. He and Colonel Stike have an enemy vanguard to crush."
Chapter 2 Ben Stike sat at the crest of a hill, his scarred face turned toward the morning sun, the ground damp and cool beneath him. He leaned against his saddle while his warhorse, Amrek, grazed nearby. The sun warmed Stike's bones, allowed him to test the limits imposed upon him by old wounds. He squeezed a handful of pebbles to strengthen the tendons in his arm that had once been cut, then healed by sorcery. A little girl, Celine, played on a crumbling dry stone wall. She skipped from stone to stone, barely seeming to pay her surroundings any mind, until one stone slipped out from beneath her, and she switched feet deftly, finding perches before she could fall. She continued down the wall 100 yards or so, and turned around, doubling her speed for the trip back. Somewhere over the nearby hills was Lady Vlora Flint, Stike's new commanding officer, along with her tiny mercenary army and hundreds of thousands of refugees from Landfall. Stike kept his own men away from the column, preferring to flank the refugees and handle the scouting. Refugees weren't his problem. Killing, when it had to be done, was. Stike squeezed the pebbles until a bead of sweat trickled down his forehead. He searched the back of his mind for his birthday, one of the many things forgotten after so long in the labor camps, and decided he was just a few months away from his 46th. Almost old enough to be Celine's grandfather. Certainly old enough to be her real father, if he'd gotten a late start. Celine reached the end of the wall nearby and leapt to the grass. She wasn't wearing shoes, despite having 2 new pairs, and her jacket and loose trousers were muddy from 3 weeks on the road. She had a girl's long hair and a soft face, but her bearing left her mistaken for a boy more times than not. She was at once skittish and confident, the daughter of a thief and toughened by years in the labor camps. She grasped Amrek fearlessly by the bridle, stroking his nose. He snorted at her, but did not kick her to oblivion, as he would anyone else so daring. Stike discarded the pebbles and brushed the grit from his hands.
The release of pressure on his tendons made him swallow a gasp, and he took a deep breath before calling to Celine.
"How do you decide which stone to step on?"
he asked her. Celine seemed surprised by the question. She left Amrek and came over to Stike's side, throwing herself down against the saddle in the mock exaggeration of a tired soldier. She was, Stike decided, spending too much time with the Lancers. Not that that would change any time soon.
"I'll just step on whichever one looks secure."
"And how do you know which is secure?"
"I just know,"
Celine said with a small shrug.
"Think, girl," Stike replied. "Think about how you know."
Celine opened her mouth, closed it again, and furrowed her brow.
"I don't step on the flat ones. They're the worst because they wobble. The ones that are shaped like..."
She made a triangle with her hands.
"Like a wedge?"
Stike urged.
Her face brightened. "Yeah, like a wedge. Those are the strongest because they rest on two other stones."
"Very good."
Stike searched in his saddlebag and found a bag of wrapped caramels that he'd discovered while looting a Black Hat supply depot before leaving landfall. He placed one in Celine's hand. Celine regarded the sweet seriously before looking up at Stike.
"Why does it matter? Didn't you tell me that instinct is a lancer's best weapon? That's what I used to find the stones, isn't it?"
Stike considered his answer and glanced down the hill. Far below them, several hundred lancers practiced drills on horseback, riding back and forth across the small valley until it was a muddy cesspit. He listened to the shouts of his officers as they barked corrections and orders.
"Instinct is just a word we use to describe all the little bits of information your senses collect, and how your brain interprets them. Instincts can be improved."
"So, when you make me interpret my instincts, you're exercising my brain? Like what you're doing with your wrists?"
Stike grunted, stifling a smirk.
"You're a clever little shit, you know that."
"Ivana says that's why you like me,"
Celine responded, sticking her chin in the air.
"Ivana says a lot of things. Most of them are bullshit."
Stike climbed to his feet, leaning down to tousle Celine's hair, then turning a critical eye on the lancers training down below. The training lasted hours each day, as Ivana whipped old lancers and new recruits alike into shape. Both men and horses had to be trained, and Stike didn't know of any army on this continent that drilled as hard as the mad lancers. But that's part of what made them the best. Stike felt an ache deep in his back, in his thighs, and in his shoulders. He took a few breaths and stretched. There was a time when he was just shy of 7 feet tall, and not a man in Fatrasta would have looked him in the eye. He was the biggest, strongest, and meanest, a hero of the Fatrastan Revolution, with a lover in every town between the coasts. Now he was a broken man, and though mended by sorcery, he was still bent from years in the labor camps, gnarled from wounds left by the firing squad.
"I'm still Ben Stike,"
he whispered to himself. He thought about going down there, participating in the drills. He was out of practice himself, and he'd had Amrek for less than a month. Any war horse big enough to carry Stike would need plenty of time learning the manoeuvres of a lancer battalion. But that could wait. Half the lancers were old comrades, gathered from landfall before it ended up in the hands of the Dionys. The other half were raw recruits. Best to remain aloof and let Ivana train them on the legend of Mad Ben Stike, rather than see the broken soul he'd become. He turned to find Celine staring at the side of his face, at the scar where a bullet had bounced off his cheekbone a decade ago. Selene had grown bold since leaving the labour camps at his side. She was bigger, stronger, responding well to a healthy diet. In 10 years, she would be a stout woman with fists of iron, and Stike pitied the men who might think her an easy tail to chase.
Ibana says not to let you feel sorry for yourself.
Stike narrowed his eyes at Selene.
What is that supposed to mean?
She says you're not as strong as you once were, and she catches you staring at your hands all the time. She says self-pity makes you a dog, and she needs you to be a man.
What the pit was Ibana doing telling all this to a little girl? Stike's little girl, particularly.
Ibana needs to shut her bloody mouth.
Selene stretched out against Amrek's saddle and stared up at the sky.
The boys have been telling me stories about you during the war.
Shit,
Stike sighed. As much as he tried to avoid it, Selene had become something of a favourite in the camp. Everyone who'd lost a daughter or a cousin or a sister back during the war took it upon themselves to tell her stories and raise her upright. Aloof or not, Stike was going to have to start cracking heads.
Did you really kill a warden with your bare hands?
Stike snorted.
I told you that story.
Yeah, but I didn't believe it before. I thought you were making stuff up. My da used to make stuff up all the time, so his friends thought he was tough. But a jackal said you did kill a warden. Did you?
I did. Broke his back, then cut his throat.
Selene nodded seriously, as if this were the response she expected.
Then Ibana's right. You shouldn't pity yourself. You're too strong to pity yourself.
Okay, Stike said, pushing her off his saddle with one toe. That's it. I'm not letting you spend time with Ibana anymore, or Jackal, or Sunin. I don't need everyone thinking they can heal me. I'm fine.
His final insistence rang a little too forceful, even to his ears.
That was over 10 years ago. You weren't even a twinkle in your daddy's eye back then. I'm not strong enough to kill a warden any more. People change. That's the nature of life.
You killed a dragon, man. I saw the body after.
Stike looked down at his hands. If he focused hard enough, he could still feel the slick, warm blood up to his elbows, the bits of brain between his knuckles.
Yeah, he said uncertainly.
The memory felt like a dream.
I did, didn't I?
He shook his head.
All right, enough of this. Help me get Amrek's saddle on him. He and I need to go through some paces before Ibana lets everything go for the day.
Stike was tightening the straps on the saddle while Selene fed Amrek an apple when he heard the sound of approaching hooves. He looked up to find Major Gusta, commander of Lady Flint's cuirassier and dragoon companies. Gusta rode with the comfortable slouch of a natural horseman, and he gave Amrek an appreciative glance as he reined in.
Afternoon, Colonel.
Gusta was a tall man, thin and bow-legged, with the shoulders of a saber-swinging cuirassier. He had brown hair, perfectly trimmed mutton chops, and a clean-shaven face. He struck Stike as the type of man who joined the cavalry to impress women, and was surprised to find he was a capable officer.
Gustav, word from Lady Flint?
Indeed, we've spotted a Dionysus vanguard.
How large?
500, mixed horse and infantry.
Any idea what kind of an army is coming up behind them?
We do. 5 brigades of infantry, and they're marching recklessly fast. Flint expects to engage them this evening.
Stike played with his big lancer's ring, looking down toward the drilling lancers. The words to an old lancer's hymn came to him, and he sang under his breath,
"Ride, lancers, ride, through the meadows against the tide.
Let your hooves ring, steel ring. Break your lances, break their bones, break their spirit against the stones.
He took a deep breath.
What are our orders? You have command of me and my cavalry again. Lady Flint is preparing a welcome for the Dynais. We're to crush their vanguard and then sweep their eastern flank to keep their scouts from seeing her preparations.
Cavalry?
Not that we've seen. We suspect that their horses are simply what they could scrounge from landfall.
Stike smirked.
We took all the good ones when we left. They'll have nothing but fourth-rate mounts.
You said they'll be here this evening?
Well, that's what we expect.
Stike looked up. It was still early in the morning, but he could tell it would be a pleasant day. It was hot, but not too hot, and the humidity was bearable. As good a day as any for killing.
Ride, lancers, ride, he sang to himself.
Louder to Gustav, he said,
Pass on the orders to Ibana. We head out within the hour.
Stike and Selene watched the arrival of the Riflejack cavalry, a force of over 1,000 that included a few hundred cuirassiers in their steel breastplates and bearskin hats, along with a larger contingent of dragoons, all riding under the Riflejack's flag of a shako over crossed rifles. Stike waited until they'd streamed into the Mad Lancer's camp, and then rode down to join them. He found his second-in-command, Ibana Jaflez, standing next to a makeshift headquarters, a tent flying the skull and lance of the Mad Lancers, issuing orders and reviewing inventory reports. Major Gustav stood nearby, his jacket resting loosely over his shoulders, hand on the butt of his sabre, eyeing his men in silence. Stike lowered Selene from the saddle and followed her down, tying Amrek to a post before heading over to join the officers. Ibana finished with a set of reports and handed them off to a soldier.
Flint has no idea how big that Dernay's army is, and she's still preparing to dig in and fight.
I don't think she has much of a choice,
Stike responded, nodding to Gustav.
She can withdraw and let them ravage the refugees, or she can pick her ground.
He asked Gustav,
What's this surprise she's preparing for them?
No idea. All I know is we need to keep them from getting a good look at her formations.
Do they have cavalry beyond those in the vanguard?
Gustav spread his hands.
Sorry. Pit. We need better information than this.
Ibana snorted.
Yeah, well, this whole venture was your idea. So what do we do?
How are the new recruits?
Stike responded with his own question.
They'll do.
Ibana sucked on her teeth.
I'd like another 3 months to train them, but that's not going to happen.
Gustav gestured toward her.
Same here. We've been trying to fill out our numbers from Adran expats and retired cavalry officers among the refugees. They're a willing bunch, but very rusty.
Like Ibana said, they would have to do. Almost a third of their number would be green or out-of-practice riders with just a few weeks of training under their belts.
Make a buddy system, he said.
A what?
Ibana replied.
A buddy system.
Stike smiled grimly.
They used to do that in the labor camps when a new batch of prisoners came in. Pair one of the new guys with two or three old hands. The old convicts were responsible for the new. Teach them the ropes, the guard singers, the schedule.
And that worked?
Ibana asked doubtfully.
Seemed to. I knew the camp quartermaster, and she said the buddy system extended life expectancy and reduced injuries.
He tapped his finger on the side of his leg thoughtfully, fiddling with his big lancer's ring.
Of course, every once in a while the old convicts would just murder the new ones for his shoes.
That, Major Gustav said, is not, reassuring.
Stike ignored him.
We do as we're told. Smash the vanguard and then go looking for trouble.
He pictured a mental map of the area, considering the refugees, the river, and Flint's forces.
The river is too deep for them to flank us, but they may send scouts. Gusta, I want you to take 150 of your dragoons and sweep the west bank. Keep eyes off of Flint.
Yes, sir.
Stike flexed his fingers, feeling that twinge in his wrist. He wasn't the young, strapping cavalry officer he'd once been. But he was the best Flint was going to get.
Ibana, take the rest of the riflejacks down the road. I'll swing wide with the lancers and we'll hit that vanguard before they know what's happening.
Stike walked among the dead on the banks of the Hedgehog after a short, bloody battle. The Dinai's vanguard had tried to withdraw when they saw the riflejacks bearing down and had run straight into the lancers. Some fled, some fought, but he'd caught them all in his pincer movement, and they'd been ground into dust in an appalling slaughter. He searched through the corpses until he found his lance, buried through the chest of a Dinai scout. The scout was a middle-aged woman, and her eyes shot open when Slyke grasped the handle of his lance. She made a deep sucking sound, her mouth bubbling blood. She tried to reach toward him. He drew his boss knife and ended her suffering with a single stroke, before reclaiming his lance, leaving the body where it lay. He wiped the gore off the tip and examined the corpses of the vanguard. The horsemen wore turquoise uniforms and carried a light kit with nothing more than a knife and an outdated carbine for defence. The infantry still carried the same short bayonets that they'd used in the assault on landfall and had been unprepared for a flanking manoeuvre by cavalry. Stike was unsurprised to see only a few bodies belonging to Riflejack dragoons and none to his lancers. Ibana approached on horseback, her roan picking its way through the bodies with an almost dainty affection.
"We got them all," she reported. "It'll take the main Dionysus army a few hours to figure out something is wrong. I've got boys set up all along the road to ambush any messengers who come looking for the vanguard."
Stike lifted his eyes from his lance and looked across the river where Gusta and his dragoons hugged the shoreline and cleaned up the handful of Dionysus who'd braved the depths of the river to flee. He tapped his ring against the lance, frowning.
"Why do I feel uneasy?"
"Too clean of a kill," Ibana suggested. "They barely put up a fight."
Stike grunted an answer and put his lancer over his shoulder and headed back to where Amrek stood nibbling at the grass on the riverbank. He patted Amrek's nose, speaking over his shoulder.
"Gather the horses. Send any prisoners back to Flint. She'll want to interrogate them. I think that..."
He trailed off, turning around to examine the field of slaughter. The dead lay scattered in a radius of about 90 yards. Riderless horses had already been captured by attentive lancers, though some had fled in the confusion. Ibana seemed to sense something was amiss.
"What is it?"
Stike climbed into Amrek's saddle and searched among his own men until he found Sunintil, an ancient woman who looked like she'd be unhorsed by a breeze. Celine sat behind Sunin in the saddle and waved when Stike gestured her over to a captured Dionysus horse.
"Tell me what's wrong with this horse," Stike said when the two approached.
Sunin opened her mouth, but Stike made a shushing motion.
"Celine?"
The girl's forehead wrinkled.
"Nothing is wrong with it," she said.
"Its health is fine, sure," Stike said. "But what about it is out of place?"
By this time, several of his officers had arrived. Looks of understanding began to dawn on their faces. They remained silent. Celine glanced around nervously, Stike watching her, trying to work out the solution.
"Don't worry about them. Worry about that horse. What can you tell me about it?"
"Small," she said. "Probably pretty quick. Not particularly strong. It was spooked by the battle. By the hindquarters, I'd say it was bred for endurance,
over other qualities. Proud smirks spread among the officers, and Stike had no doubt each of them would take credit for teaching Selene about horses. But he knew where she really learned it, and stifled his own smile.
What kind is it?
It might... she hesitated. It might be a Eunice Desert racer, but I haven't seen a horse with those markings before.
Neither have I, Stike said. Neither has any of us.
He swung down from Amrek and gave the captured horse a quick walk around, treating it to a whisper and a light touch to calm its nerves. He returned to Amrek and pulled himself into the saddle.
I'll bet my saddle this is Dionysian.
Mutters followed the proclamation.
I've never heard of that, Selene said.
That's because the Dionys have been a closed nation for over 100 years, and before that they weren't exactly friendly.
Stike searched his memory.
Supposedly, Dionysians were bred for, as you said, endurance. They're an all-purpose horse, meant to be docile, obedient, generic, and easily interchangeable. Just about every Fortrastan breed has a bit of Dionysian in them, going back to when the Dionys actually ruled this damn place.
So, what's so special about this one? Selene asked.
Nothing more than any of the others, Stike said, gesturing toward a group of lancers attempting to run down riderless horses up on the ridge.
Ivana snorted. We don't have time for this, Ben. Tell the girl what you're getting at.
Right, Stike said.
He stretched his fingers and adjusted his lance before climbing back into Emmerich's saddle.
A Dionysian here means that the Dionys have cavalry. They're not just using scrounged fourth-rate Fortrastan horses.
He meditated on the possibilities for a moment.
We're not just sweeping for scouts now. We're looking for an enemy cavalry force, and we have no idea how big it'll be.
He looked around at his officers.
Strip the bodies of anything useful.
They were on the move again within 15 minutes. Captured horses trailed behind their column, and Stike made sure that his buddy system was still in place. They'd had more injuries during that quick battle from green riders getting fingers tangled in the reins than they had from actual enemy combatants, and he needed to keep those kind of accidents to a minimum. They headed east away from the river, then cut south to flank it, being sure to keep at least 2 hills between themselves and the river valley at all times. His own scouting parties fanned out to watch for contact with the enemy army. Stike couldn't help but shake a feeling of uneasiness. He shouldn't be surprised by Dionysian cavalry. Not really. Lancers would make quick work of any force riding Dionysian mounts, so what was bothering him? The prospect of greater numbers? Disappointment that he had more to worry about than flanking enemy infantry? He was still pondering this question almost an hour later when Umbana joined him at a gallop.
"We've made contact!" she shouted.
Stike snapped out of his reverie.
"Where? To the west? From the river?"
"No, south. Directly south."
Ivana was flushed, and she immediately began barking orders. Stike was about to ask for an explanation when he topped a small rise in the landscape and inhaled sharply. Directly in front of them, riding in their direction, was a wide column of Dionysian cavalry. Breastplates shone in the evening sun, and at half a mile he could see that they were armed with sabres and pistols. Their column was spread out, moving at a walk with no real cohesion, and he could see a sudden flurry of excitement ripple through them. Ivana raised her looking glass to her eye for a moment, then stowed it in her packs with a curse.
"They're as surprised as we are. God damn it! We must have taken out each other's scouts."
It didn't take a genius to realize why they were here. The Dionys cavalry were going to attempt the same thing as the lancers, flank the enemy.
But instead of a handful of ill-equipped riders on fourth-rate horses, these were Dainai's cuirassiers, and there appeared to be almost 2,000 of them. "Orders, sir?" Ibana asked. "We're outnumbered, and have no element of surprise. All things being equal,